There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen, and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Along with me, the always affable Mr. Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey.
Today, Tim, I don't know if you know this, January 27th is World Holocaust Awareness Day. It's an interesting little aspect. And our buddy Gavin Davies, who we've had on the show and has helped supply us with quite a few guests, reached out and said, I've got an amazing guest you need to talk to. She has a new book out. It is a novel, but it's based on her family and their story. And it's filled with strange bits of information in the paranormal. And I think, Dave, this would be a great show for you. Well, we've worked with Gavin so many times. I'm like, sign me up, buddy. What do we do? How do we get her on? Let's do this. So today joining us is Sylvia True. She's the author of the book Where Madness Lies, based on her own grandmother's experiences in Nazi Germany with strong mental health, human survival, and paranormal experiences interwoven. Thank you so much for being here with us today, Sylvia.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
And my understanding is your students are happy I'm having you right now too, right? Because it gives them a break?
Yes, because I wrote down the wrong Tuesday, so I was in the middle of teaching about intermolecular forces, which is a different kind of force, and they are thrilled that I had to take a break from them for a few minutes, or a little bit more than a few minutes.
Right. Well, we appreciate that, and we appreciate them giving their teacher up for a little bit to talk to us about this book. Now, you wrote this as a novel. Is that, again, because you're not there for every conversation, every version of how the history unfolded, so a lot of this is left up to the imaginings of what you're doing, but using the history that's been told to you?
Yes. So that's a great question. And it's interesting why it had to get written as a novel. And part of it is because, yes, all of the details of the history were not told to me, although the major ones, the major plot points were. But it's interesting as to why, many people who fled from Nazi Germany, and both my families, my father's family and my mother's family, fled from Germany. Many people just did not want to talk about it. It was very traumatic and they kept it sort of locked up and repressed. And that repression, of course, led to other difficulties within the family and other problems. And really, it is a story about my grandmother, and it is actually a story about me as well and my struggles with mental illness. And when I was hospitalized for depression and anxiety shortly after my first daughter was born, it was my grandmother who actually came to help. And what she did was she had to expose her truth and what happened to her in Germany and her sister who was mentally ill. And by doing that, it was a great healing process for me. And that wasn't the only thing that healed me. There was medication then available that wasn't available in her sister's time. But yes, yeah, so some of the things had to, had to be written through my research, because a lot of the details, the smaller details, were not told to me.
So almost like in the sense of Truman Capote's In Cold Blood, a true story written in a novelistic approach. I appreciate that. And again, just to give people an entertaining lock into this story, giving them something to tie into. Now, Where Madness Lies. Now, this is a story about of course, the high price of repression in Nazi Germany. How does that link to your grandmother and your own family?
So that was sort of what I was just talking about in terms of hiding and repressing what happened. So what happened to my grandmother, she lived in Frankfurt. She was, you know, a wealthy, very well-educated woman. Her younger sister was mentally ill, and she adored and loved her sister and tried to do everything she could for her sister. All kinds of research, finding the best doctors. But, you know, unfortunately, for a number of different reasons, especially because of what was going on with the Nazi Party at that time, her sister could not be saved. And so my grandmother left Germany with her mother and her daughter, but lost really everything, her country, her, you know, place in society, her sister. And I think when she fled to Switzerland, she really closed the door on that part of her life and kept it in a separate compartment, sort of repressed it. And because of that repression, I think what happened to my grandmother, and I don't think this is uncommon, you know, she tried to control all different aspects of her life that she couldn't control, right, in Germany. So she became sort of rigid and controlling. You know, for example, I mean, all her clocks in her house had to go off at exactly the same time every day, and she made sure that happened. Now, again, that's not something terribly odd, but it is a reaction, or her need to control was a reaction to the control she didn't have. And then she also repressed what happened to her sister. And that repression comes out then in forms of anxiety and depression. And not dissimilarly, my father also, his family fled also from Frankfurt, they fled to England. He also repressed a lot of his childhood, and his repression came out in real anger, at kind of crazy things, like the curtains weren't closed properly, or I don't know, we would get yelled at every night about, you know, we left a light on, or I don't know, the yelling that happened wasn't really about the curtains not being closed all the way. It was about something else. And it took me many years to understand that. And of course, being in a mental hospital, to understand how deeply, you know, the repression of what happened to them in Germany affected later generations in our family.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. And I would guess that surviving that type of situation, the want and desire for some kind of control, even though it to outliers might seem like pettiness or OCD, it's this, you're trying to feel like you have some part of your life that you're able to hold on to keep
right.
control. What now, talking about Nazi Germany, obviously we know what horrific things they did, but what can you tell us? I mean, how did they treat people with mental illness?
So I think that if you look at the history of mental illness in Nazi Germany, it's pretty fascinating, and you can really sort of see it as the Nazis' opening act. And well, first what happened, I think if you go back a little ways to 1888, there was a guy called Sir Francis Dalton, and he came up with the term eugenics, right, which was had to do with purifying the race.
Exactly.
And it was really something that was looked at as a thing in biology. You know, how do we get rid of disease? And I mean, we look at that right now. How do we get rid of COVID, right? I mean, we're looking at how to rid people of disease. And this, the idea of eugenics was, again, a biological concept that, you know, we don't, you know, people with diseases don't quote unquote breed, and then we'll get a healthier race. And this idea of eugenics was believed throughout the world. It wasn't in just in Germany. I mean, it was certainly in the U.S. too. In fact, at the beginning, the U.S. was leading in the numbers of sterilizations. But, you know, the Nazis took it, obviously, to an extreme. And in 1933, they enacted their sterilization law, and they sterilized from 1934 to 1939, 400,000 people. And people who were sterilized were people who were deemed mentally unfit for all sorts of reasons. There was feeble-mindedness, which covered, you know, a huge spectrum, and schizophrenia and blindness and congenital deafness and even alcoholism. You know, people were sterilized for that. And that, those ideas of eugenics then took the Nazis, or the Nazis took it further to then eventually euthanize or murder mentally ill patients. And there were six major sanatoriums where they built gas chambers, and they built the gas chambers there. They had crematoriums there. They pillaged bodies. So everything that happened later in the concentration camps happened first in the mental hospitals. And those doctors that built the mental hospitals, those doctors that built the gas chambers in the mental hospitals were the same doctors that built the design and built them in the concentration camps. So it was their, you know, the killing of the mental patients really was their opening act.
That's just, I understand that it wasn't strictly contained to Nazis, but it obviously seems like they took things to a whole new level when it came to mentality, right? Now, as we started this story that you've written, Where Madness Lies, the names have been changed to protect the innocent, right? And some of the details, but give us some specifics, if you would, on the scope of this part of our history that, you know, maybe a lot of people don't know of or are not as acutely aware of.
The part about what happened to the mentally ill in Germany.
That and just, you know, I mean, the entire aspect of, well, first of all, you know, you sit down to write this story. You've actually been affected or perhaps afflicted. I'm not sure what the proper terminology now would be with your own mental health issues dealing with things. What makes you decide to pick up pen and paper and go into dealing with not only your past family's issues, but delving into your own world of them?
Right. That's such a great question. Thank you. It's funny because my sister, through all of this, I'm going to do a little tangent here. She is a really well-known child psychiatrist. She became a psychiatrist after, in part, after what she saw, you know, when she witnessed what I went through. And we were just talking about therapy the other day. And, you know, I was saying I basically do my therapy. I still go to a therapist, but I basically do my therapy through writing. I mean, it makes me look, you know, you take a first glance, that first layer, and then you have to keep digging deeper and, you know, really questioning what emotions are there and what feelings and why. But anyway, in part, I mean, I think writing any, you know, often, regardless of how fictionalized it is, there's an enormous amount of therapy. It's a very therapeutic hobby. All right, that being said, so I'm going to try to go from the beginning and connect the dots. So my grandmother in Germany tried to take care of her sister until it was no longer possible and had to leave. And she lived in Switzerland, and she was the matriarch of our family. I mean, she was very sort of domineering. She had a lot of power somehow emotionally over us, and you know, we were all sort of in awe of her and maybe a little terrified of her, and she was, you know, super strict. And I definitely had a lot of insecurities growing up, and in part because of her. And there was this need to be perfect, and I didn't understand it at the time. You know, we were never allowed to show weakness. We always, you know, had to be emotionally fine. We had to pull up our socks, you know. And I was told I was often oversensitive, which is, you know, when you think about that, it's kind of a weird thing to say, because, you know, it's good to be a little sensitive, but I was oversensitive. Things affected me too much. And so I think from a very young age, I was struggling with depression, but it clearly wasn't allowed. So I, you know, faked it, whatever, you know, pretended to be feel fine when I wasn't fine. And then as the years went on, I struggled more and more, and I didn't know how to deal with it. I just, you know, believed I was this weak person who couldn't really deal with life the way most people could deal with life. And I thought, oh, well, you know, what'll cure it is having a baby. Well, it's not really a good cure for anything. Although it was a great decision in hindsight. I mean, my children are my biggest, best gift, obviously, by far. But anyway, so here I was, 25. I'm like, okay, things are getting worse. I'm getting more unstable. I can feel it. I'm not allowed to show it. I feel panicked all the time. I couldn't really drive anymore. I mean, I don't know why, I just got too panicked. I, you know, had agoraphobia, which is like fear of the marketplace. And so I couldn't go to the grocery store. I was, you know, just more claustrophobic, more panicked, more depressed, not able to sleep. Yes. So great idea, Sylvia, go and have a baby. So I had a baby, a perfectly beautiful 10-pound baby. And then very shortly after that, I mean, I just really fell off completely. Like I was trying to walk a tightrope and there was no way I could keep walking it. So I ended up in McLean, which is outside of Boston. It's a, you know, it's a well-known mental hospital. And I mean, I had the best lessons of my life there and really got the help I needed. The help I needed from a therapist and the help also with medicine. But the other piece that came into play was my family history. Now, when I went into the hospital, my mother and my grandmother were totally terrified. I mean, because they were keeping the secret that I had no idea that there was a history of mental illness. And one of the first things, you know, you're asked, you probably don't know when you're, you know, on your intake, when, you know, they interview you, you know, is there any mental history in your family? And I remember saying, oh, absolutely not. My family is perfect. And I literally said that. My family is perfect because that's what they wanted the world to see. And that partly came from the Nazis. So when I went into the hospital, I mean, my mother and my grandmother were absolutely terrified and probably ashamed as well. But eventually they got over that fear and were able to share with me what happened in the past. And for me, learning that I wasn't alone, like that I wasn't the only weak, quote unquote weak, because it's not considered weak anymore. And that's a very important point. I wasn't the weak link. You know, this had happened in my family. This had happened in Nazi Germany in the most terrifying way. And so the book sort of takes you from this darkness, right? And this need for my grandmother to shut down everything that happens into the light, because eventually her ability to reflect, to share, to open up is what led to a true connectedness between us and a love. I mean, and what's more important than love? So that was sort of a long answer.
Oh, it perfectly fills the missing spots. Now, again, in reexamining and looking at your family history, you've got, you know, some aside from the mental illnesses that they dealt with in the point of history that they were a part of, there are other interesting facets. Am I to understand this right? Your grandfather was the doctor for Anne Frank's family?
Yes, my grandfather on my father's side. So again, both families were in Frankfurt. They didn't know each other in Frankfurt. So it's kind of amazing that they met later in England. But my grandfather on my father's side was the doctor of the Frank family before they fled to Amsterdam. And my grandfather was just this wonderful, kind, sensitive, compassionate human being. And he truly didn't believe that this evil would occur. He just didn't believe people could do that to other people. But he did move to England. He got out in the nick of time. He was literally pushed onto a train by his cousin because he just didn't, he was like, no, it's not going to get that bad. It's not going to happen. You know, there was no way he could believe it. And they stripped him of his medical degree. So he had to go and get another medical degree. And later, only a few, believe it or not, a few years ago, they reinstated his medical degree, which is nice, but a little odd and a little late.
Yeah, the sometimes the choices of reparations in those senses don't always make sense. But I guess the concept of, you know, we want him to be recognized that he did right. this not once, but twice. I mean, that says something about your grandfather as well, that, you know, he was willing to go through the reeducation in order to continue being a help. What exactly did your family have to do to survive that time?
So, I think people survive in all kinds of different ways. I mean, obviously, most of them fled. Not all of them were able to get out on my father's side. And I think one of the major things they did was repression, you know, not think about it, you know, compartmentalize it, put it in another part of their brain. And I think what my mother did was really interesting. And, you know, I don't know how conscious it was when she was young, but my mother used physical activity. And when she was pretty young, a doctor said she had weak ankles, and so she needed to take up skating. I don't think there really is such a thing as weak ankles, but nevertheless, she took up skating. And I think that gave her so much that the physical outlet was extremely important. And she actually became Swiss national champion skater with that. And later, you know, we moved to this country, and she again, you know, she did some coursework and she got a graduate degree, but then she went right back to skating and became a wonderful skating coach. So I think, you know, in order to cope with her anxiety, she coped with her anxiety and some depression as well, because again, these are things we were not allowed to show. She coped with it through physical activity.
Well, I will tell you, I had weak ankles growing up, so they are a thing. I don't know. No. I seem to roll my ankles every 3 days. It was ridiculous. So, yeah, and I wish it at my age now that wasn't an issue, but I do have to be careful. I don't know if it's just the way I walk or whatever, but yeah, I've rolled my ankles on many, many occasions, and it's not a fun thing.
Now, what does that mean when you roll your ankles?
Twisting your ankle. You just kind of like you're walking and it gives out or so. You know, it's like you catch something just on the side and roll your ankle. It's a bizarre deal, but boy, does it suck. It's, so building up the ankles and skating is probably a good thing, you know, for her. But again, as you said, it ends up turning out to be a really good, passionate outlet for her.
And actually, if I can interject for just a second, all weak ankles means is that the ligaments aren't as supportive as they should be. That's all it means.
Does skating help?
Yes, it actually toughens up the ligaments.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, I am so glad. So that I really learned something today, because my mother always said it was just a sort of an old wives' tale that anybody had weak ankles, and I just assumed she knew. And I don't think she had weak. I don't know why they put her on. I mean, the doctor maybe thought she walked a little funny, and I don't know. She had pretty strong ankles, and
It actually strengthens all the muscles and the ligaments in the ankle. And actually, it's like tightening up your core when you have a back injury. It does the exact same thing.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yep.
Thank you.
The more you know, doom, doom, right. Doom, doom. now, you know, I'm curious, you start to hear this trend through your family that's put up this protective shell. And don't worry, folks, we're getting to the paranormal. But you've got this family that puts up a protective shell of everything's fine, everything's all right, let's repress this. You begin dealing with this. Your thoughts when dealing with it is, let me have a baby, maybe that will help. You know, is mental health something that we truly inherit, or is it something that, you know, is affected by our circumstances?
Yeah, I think it's definitely both. I remember in college many, many years ago. I remember because it's so different now. We were taught that 80% of your personality and who you are was environment and 20% was genetic. And I think now we look at those numbers and I don't know the exact numbers, but we could probably agree that it's, well, let's say at least 50-50, right? We know a lot more now about genetics and that there are a lot of things that are genetic. And certainly in my family, this cord or thread of depression is clearly genetic. Both my daughters inherited depression and anxiety, although one is clearly more on the depressed side and the other is clearly more on the anxiety side. Luckily, I got both, right? No, but, you know, they're fine and treatment for them wasn't, you know, shrouded in all this shame and everything else. But I do think there's a strong genetic piece and people should know their histories. It's so important to know your history and what is in that history. I mean, is it entirely genetic? I doubt it. I mean, maybe something environmental things could have been changed and my depression would have been less, but there is definitely a genetic component for me.
Did you have a concern? Like, did you have a concern knowing that you were dealing with mental disorder of having children that it might be something that would be passed on to them? Or do you remember at that point, did it even cross your mind?
Well, so that's such a great question because I didn't have that concern because I honestly didn't believe that I had any mental illness or mental problems because I that's what I had been told, like, you're fine, I'm fine. Even though, of course, I knew I wasn't fine, but I also didn't believe that, I was mentally ill. And then when I learned so much about depression and how treatable it is, I mean, when my eldest daughter first started showing signs of depression, I mean, I was all over it, like the opposite of my family, right? I mean, I took her to a psychiatrist, a therapist, and a psychic, of course. I mean, I attacked it from all angles, you know, not enough therapy or psychics in the world.
So in taking that step, I mean, how do you, you know, I'm just curious, how do you go from psychologists, psychiatrists to looking even into psychics? I mean, where does that leap? Because a lot of people wouldn't even consider that as a possibility of a way to look into what's going on.
I know, you know, and that's really, this fascinates me probably more than anything, right? Why people wouldn't look into that. And I'm not saying they should or shouldn't. I'm just curious, like, why wouldn't you think of that as a way to heal? Because there are people out there that have these gifts. And in my case, I was very fortunate. It was soon after I actually got out of McLean that I met a friend whose mother happened to be a psychic. Now, I come from a very, very scientific family, right? Tons of scientists. My father was a theoretical nuclear physicist. My other grandfather was a chemist. There are lots of doctors. So they were like, you know, this was stuff like you are not allowed to believe in psychic. But I met this person whose mother was a psychic and I listened to his stories and I was curious and I was intrigued and I was really healthy for the first time. I was stronger and I was willing to pursue all kinds of different educations in a sense. And I went to this woman and I was blown away. I was completely blown away about what she knew. And she then, for 30 years, she died about a year ago. She was 91. But for 30 years, she became my mentor and my guide and my friend. And in many ways, she helped me more than anyone, you know, through her readings and through what she saw in the cards. She had a clearer picture. She could say, well, this is what's going on. You know, it didn't take 24 sessions to sort of pull it out with a you know, pull it out with therapy. Not that that's not a great thing to do. It is a great thing to do. But to discount the psychics as a way to help is just really is sad for me. I mean, so anyway, I, of course, brought my daughters to see my psychic, whose name is Sophie, when they had any kind of problems. And she was tremendously helpful.
Well, we'll dig into that because I'm fascinated to that aspect of this. But, you know, I want to go a little bit more into your whole story here. We need to take a break. We'll come back. The paranormal is right around the corner. We've set the stage. Our guest, Sylvia True, the book Where Madness Lies. We have a link for that book in today's program so you can find it. Thank you so much. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more right after this. Welcome back. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there is Tim Dennis. And our guest today, Sylvia True. She's the author of a book, Where Madness Lies. We have a link for that book in today's program guide. So make sure that you go buy it, rate it, review it. And let's dive back in. Now, you have kind of set the stage of the family that you were a part of, the obviously the very hectic and chaotic atmosphere of the life that they led. Did your grandmother or anybody else that had been afflicted with depression and anxiety, did they ever admit to any sensitivities, paranormal sensitivities at all?
My mother did much okay. Later on. My mother definitely had, I think, intuitions about things and also dreams. But again, it's interesting. It didn't happen until sort of I came out of the mental hospital. And also since, you know, after revealing some of the secrets, then slowly things, you know, became more and more open. And I certainly became more open, especially to the whole psychic paranormal world.
Well, let's address the elephant in the room, because I know this will be a big contention for many of the skeptical listeners that we have. Well, if your guest, Dave, is talking about dealing with mental issues and it's something that's been inherited through her family, of course, they're going to think they've got sensitivities or they see ghosts or they're psychic because they're compromised. How do you respond to something like that?
So, yeah, part of me wants to respond by saying, look at different cultures. In our culture, I'm not going to say we're not allowed to believe in it, but it's sort of looked down on and poo-pooed, right? Now, you can go to other cultures, and I go to Peru into the jungle to do, you know, biological research. But also, you know, if you look at their culture and look at what they believe, you know, they believe the trees, the wind, they have spirit. You know, a family can actually feel like, you know, another family put a curse or a hex on them and the police will actually investigate. And our culture finds all that laughable, right? And so I think the first thing you have to do is look to other cultures and see that other cultures believe that if somebody maybe hears voices or sees visions, they have a gift and, you know, they need to take that gift and become a shaman even. Now, of course, I'm not saying everybody who hears voices or has visions is that they're hearing that from the other side. You know, some people have truly psychotic breaks and need medication and hospitalization. But I do know that there are people who are hospitalized and told that they're crazy when they really are getting visits from the other side.
Yeah, that's a compelling and kind of terrifying aspect of it all, right? I mean, you don't know, and you wonder how many people that were being given these gifts, given these aspects, were hospitalized, traumatized, tortured, humiliated, but, you know, when in fact they really were seeing these things, you know, my daughters wanted to watch this movie on Fatima, and we watched it last week, and it's a beautiful little retelling of the story of the Lady of Fatima, the visions that came 6 months right. in a row, and how easy it was for, you know, the locals and the mayor and the police to say these girls are liars, they're fakes, they're frauds. But as each time they would kneel down and pray and see the Virgin Mary, the Virgin would tell them, to get the information I'm going to give you, there's going to be much suffering. And you think, wow, well, who would keep that, especially somebody lordly, right? Like the Virgin Mary, why would you put that upon a child? And then these kids are given this gift, but then you see that where belief lies, the normalcy of government did not want to admit that she was seeing, that these girls were seeing these things in this little boy. But with every report of it, the crowd would grow until the final visitation, which had over 77,000 people in attendance. Wow. And I believe it was most, if not all, witnessed the miracle that had been promised, which was this, the sun was like dancing in the sky and then looked like it plunged towards earth and then pulled back up. It was beautiful, majestic, terrifying, and then a relief again, all at the same time. But in order to get to that point, there had to be the questions. There had, your faith was tested. You had to be put to this limit. And it was an interesting aspect, but kind of hearing that as well with people that might be gifted that are considered crazy or schizophrenic, dissociative behaviors, things like that. Is it really that, or is that their test in trying to, you know, you get these messages with every gift, there comes a curse.
Right. It's so fascinating. I'm about 2 minutes from the Fatima Shrine here.
Wow.
Yeah. And we go in the, you know, in the winter when they have all the lights up, but that's such a fascinating story. I mean,
I guess I didn't even realize that you were that close to it, but that's something I'd, yeah. I mean, that I just watched that film on, I think it was Amazon or so this last week with my daughters. And it's really powerful to see conviction, and especially in children in this aspect. And you think about how the quote unquote crazy are convicted to, no, this is what I see, this is what I know. And how many of them have been just summarily dismissed instead of looked at for, you know, what is crazy? What is there a thin line? And you know this. I mean, you've got family members that are brilliant scientists. I think there's a very thin line between crazy and genius, a very right. thin, right?
Yeah, there can be. Absolutely.
Because but you have to have that like, wild imagination to see, to experience, to right. want to go beyond the normal and make that breakthrough. And you can't do it just being redundant.
So children, I think it's so fascinating with children. I mean, children are so much more open by nature to any kind of paranormal visits. And, you know, then of course we tell them, our society for the most part tells them, no, that's just an imaginary friend. That's nothing real. And, you know, and again, I think that it's so important to look at other cultures, because you look at cultures like in India, where if a child talks about a past life experience and they give enough details about that experience, you know, the family really listens, and they try mm-hmm. to then find the family, and often do find the families, because sometimes they're not that far apart in distance, where the child had a, you know, a past life with that other family, and
right.
they celebrate it. It's not something that's crazy or shameful. And I don't know, you probably know about the University of Virginia and all the research they're doing, but there's
right.
this wonderful guy, Jim Tucker, and he does this, gives this talk about, you know, the boy who lived before, and they collect an enormous amount of data, and you know, they used to do it most in India, and now he's really focusing on collecting data here in the States, because, you know, he wants people to see that this does happen, and they have, you know, they have enough data points where they can actually say a case is resolved, and that, yeah, this boy lived this other life before and remembers a lot of it. And then oftentimes the children at around 6 or 7 stop either having the visions or remembering for whatever reason. But it really is something that, you know, I think it's fascinating. And there's so much data out there, and there's a lot of good research. And, you know, I hope people don't just push it away because it seems too woo or whatever.
Right. Doesn't fit their paradigm. The biggest and best transitions in the world that have happened have all happened on the ideas, the crazy ideas of one person. And then it's the exploration of those ideas that makes it realize there is more to this. And I think we're now in 2021, we're at a point with paranormal on every TV channel and movies and everything. I think people have become much more open and accepting of it. They may not necessarily believe that it's true, but they're a lot more willing to have open discussions. And obviously you have a strong belief in the paranormal, and you know, it's clear in your book when you talk about the visions that these are paranormal visions. Is it your hope that the readers will pick up on that as well, or do you think that most are going to read this and think that these are also parts of a mental breakdown or mental disability?
Well, it's interesting. So there's one character in the book, mm-hmm. Cece, her name is, and she has very clear visions of spirits, and she has visions of my grandmother's sister, and she sees my grandmother's sister behind my grandmother, right? And I think most readers will accept that, well, I guess you can discount it as crazy or maybe just some freaky coincidence, but I think it's pretty clear they're paranormal visions. And the reason she ended up in the mental hospital in the first place is she was living sort of in a group home, and she knew there was going to be a fire in the home, a bad fire. And she tried to warn people, and then there was a fire, and then they accused her because she knew of it. You know, she had, you know, a psychic awareness before. They accused her of setting the fire. So she is an example of someone who is clearly not mentally ill and has some sort of visions. And the reason it was an important reason for me to include this aspect in the book, because it really pushes the boundaries, especially on my grandmother, who was so closed. And one of the things I like to say to my students and to people, you know, only a closed mind is certain. So you really have to get to a certain openness. And this particular character and her visions pushes on some of Inga, that's a grandmother, it pushes on some of her more closed off ideas, you know. And in the end, the book really is about the two main characters, which would be my grandmother and me, having these open conversations and being, you know, being willing to be vulnerable, being willing to talk about, you know, their different viewpoints, their different prejudices, and finally being able to really understand the other and have empathy. And that's the only, in my mind, that's the only way you can get to a place of real love is, you know, through empathy and understanding.
I agree. Now, why did you decide, I mean, in a book that's this kind of important, why decide to add the element of the paranormal layer to it?
Well, yeah, for a few reasons. Because I have such a strong belief in it, and because I've been guided, you know, for over 30 years by a psychic, which I know some people will be like, oh God, well, I can talk more about that in a minute. But, and because I believe that there is this link, and I believe that, you know, I was given guidance from my mother to help write this book. And I believe it's really important for people to question this, you know, and especially the character Inga in the book. It was really important to have that layer, to have her question in the end. She actually does, and it's a little blurry, you know, whether or not it's a clear vision, but in the end she does see her sister come for her. And I remember when my mother died, it was really clear that her parents were there to help her cross. So, you know, it's an important piece of the family, like the past and the future sort of linking together, like they're still connected.
It is. And that gives, you know, part of the reason I love the paranormal is because you realize that history isn't really over. It's replaying. You just, if you become sensitive enough to it or you're open enough to it, sometimes you're lucky enough to capture a piece of it.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. So,
go, if you could, again, kind of tell me about the elements of your life that connects to the events of Where Madness Lies in your life personally.
Well, the most direct events are obviously the, you know, the mental illness piece and the depression piece. And then I think, though, that when we talk about the openness piece, that my, you know, I think I've been given so many gifts in life. I'm not gifted. I'm not a great medium or anything like that. I'm given the gift to, you know, be able to get well, given the gift of being able to have my children, and also the gift of being open to these, the psychics and the mediums I've seen. And my journey with, you know, the paranormal, I don't know. I don't even know if I love that word, but with psychics and mediums has been just so fascinating. And mostly it started with this one woman, Sophie, who read regular cards. She didn't read tarot cards. And, you know, playing cards, as we call them now, were actually, you know, when they were first designed, they were designed to read the future. They weren't designed to play card games with, right?
Right.
And she read regular playing cards, and I mean, told me, I don't know, the specificity of her readings. I'm going to give you one kind of crazy story example, but when my oldest daughter, Erica, was pregnant with her first child, she was very anxious about it. She had had a miscarriage not long before this pregnancy of her first child. And she went for an ultrasound. She happened to go for an ultrasound. They did it on New Year's Eve. And I was in Chicago with my dad and Erica was in Boston, and she called, and she was so hysterical. She couldn't even speak. I mean, she just was, you know, barely could speak. And finally her husband got on the phone and said, the ultrasound technician said something that about an enlarged artery in the baby's head, and Erica's like now obviously devastated and worried and anxious. And I was like thinking, oh my God, an artery in the head? That doesn't make sense. I don't know what they're talking about, but I knew how upset Erica was. So, you know, we talked for a little, got off the phone, and I was obviously really anxious too. And I have a number of doctors in my family, including a radiologist who I could have called, but no, I called my psychic Sophie. And I was like, you need to help me. You need to tell me what's going on. And she over the phone read a few cards, and she said, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the baby at all. There's nothing wrong with the baby. She said, but Erica cannot have sex for 2 weeks. And I was like, okay, well, I don't know if I can tell her that, but, and she kept saying it. She can't have sex for 2 weeks. Something hasn't moved yet, she said. And the baby's fine. It's ridiculous that she thinks anything's wrong with the baby. And I was like, okay. Then I could call, you know, take a deep breath, maybe call the radiologist in the family. And we found out that there wasn't an artery in the baby's head. That the technician had said there was an artifact. So artifacts are, you know, something that can be in a sonogram and make it look not quite, you know, it's just a sound wave thing. It has nothing to do with the baby. So the doctor said, Erica went to the doctor a couple days later, and the doctor said, yeah, the baby's fine, but your placenta hasn't moved yet. And it's still sort of low, it's still sort of on the low side. So if you do have sex, you might bleed or spot a little. Don't panic. But if you do panic, just come to me and I'll give you another ultrasound. Well, of course, Erica had sex and bled and had another ultrasound and was totally fine. But that Sophie could see somehow, you know, well, that the baby was fine, people might say, oh, yeah, well, you know, anybody could say that. But she saw that, you know, it would take 2 weeks for the placenta to move, that it hadn't moved yet. And she didn't know, she didn't call it the placenta. But, I mean, that's just amazing to me. And, I mean, I have so many of those stories that just, you know, when I tell them to people, I'm like, how can you not believe that some people have this paranormal ability, you know?
Right. Well, and as we see that on the show and we hear things and, you know, Tim and I have had our own experiences, you can't always just throw the baby out with the bathwater because it doesn't make logical sense. You know, again, sometimes the best experiences are those that mystify us and come out of nowhere. Are there always answers? No. And that's okay. Even the best skeptics will tell you that they can't tell you what caused that, but it's interesting. I won't go as far as to say that was a ghost, Dave. That's what Dr. Michael Shermer told me. But I will say that was interesting. That was really interesting. So it's fun to see that there is that kind of give and take as well. You know, and as long as we can remain open to the concepts or the possibilities, that's where the magic may actually lie for us. With this layer of the paranormal throughout, you know, what do you hope people really, you know, obviously you've got history, entertainment, paranormal, kind of this mix, but what's your hope for a takeaway for the audience that reads this book?
I guess in the end, it's just, you almost just said it. I mean, it's, you know, being open, right? Being open and being able to really listen. Yeah, there's like sort of the cautionary tale of don't keep secrets, right? That secrets are, you know, ultimately can be very painful and destructive. And I think they were. But it's about being open and being able to have those open and honest conversations, being able to talk about things that are painful and or shameful. You know, and that's really important to me because there's still, you know, I think we've come a long way with mental health, absolutely, but there's still certain stigmas around it. And I, you know, I find it's really important for my students, obviously for my children, but my children sort of grew up with this crazy open mother who went to psychiatrists and psychics and wherever to, you know, get information and help. But it's really important for me to teach my students, even though I teach chemistry, you know, to sort of say, this is, you know, this is normal. I mean, people feel oftentimes depressed or anxious and have struggles with mental illness, but you can overcome it. And there really is hope, you know, and the way to get there is to be open about it and to talk about it.
Agreed. I hope people will consider that, you know, before. Yeah, I think, again, as with the paranormal and with mental health, people have become a lot more accepting and understanding, and people are a lot more open about dealing with their own issues, I think. I see
absolutely.
It more. I don't know if we can thank social media for that or what, but a lot of people are more willing to discuss and be open about that. I think some of that stigma is slowly being removed. Now, with... You know, here we are 80 years into this story. And what do you really, you know, what is your hopes for people that do suffer from mental health issues? And if they pick up this book, if they read them, or family or friends of people that are dealing with different mental health issues?
Right. That's a great question. That, you know, that there is help and support available. And, you know, I mean, I guess, and because I obviously teach children, teenagers, but, you know, don't stop trying. You know, part of feeling depressed is having this feeling of hopelessness, right? And you know, so your emotions are sort of telling you it's hopeless. And you have to use your brain to say, it's not hopeless. I can get help. their support. If you don't like the first doctor or therapist, whoever you see, go find another one, you know. So, you know, that book ultimately, like I said earlier, hopefully is a journey from sort of this dark time to a more hopeful light time where there's help, there are new medications that are amazing now, and you know, there really is help and hope there.
Very cool. And I hope people will find that. Again, when you read a book like this, it gives you an insight into other people's struggles and stories. But, you know, here we are, 2021, right? And there's uncertainty around every corner. People don't know what the future of politics or the future of health with the coronavirus or the future of our finances, all of this, you know, it's, I think, is starting to cause some fractures in people who otherwise might not have had mental issues. How do you think Where Madness Lies can help us as we head into this kind of uncertain future and continue to work our way through it?
Right. I mean, it's a very difficult time. And as I said earlier, only a closed mind is certain. So, you know, I believe we have to embrace the uncertainty, and that can be really difficult. I don't say that lightly. One of my daughters is really struggling with, she just wants to know, when is this going to be over? When's everything going to be normal? I'm like, it's not going to be normal, or it's going to be a new normal. And you have to try to embrace some of the changes and some of the uncertainty and, you know, keep talking about it. I mean, keep listening, especially when it comes to, there's not just one other side, but, you know, there are different sides and people have different opinions and different views. And we really need to stop pointing fingers and stop blaming each other and start really listening to each other and trying to understand where we're coming from. I mean, what is causing some of these extreme beliefs? I mean, is it born out of some fears? And I think if we can stop and we can listen and we can have empathy, we'll get a lot further. And then, you know, all this anxiety, I'm not saying it's all going to end. I wish it would all end, but, you know, through listening and through having empathy, we can certainly reduce a lot of the anxiety and a lot of the fear that's out there.
Being a heavily slanted paranormal show, do you have some other paranormal stories and anecdotes you'd like to share with listeners? Other things that you maybe have come to light from your own family?
I'm trying to think of, I do have a kind of an interesting another one. Most of my experiences, I've had dreams that are definitely psychic dreams that have, you know, like come to pass in almost exactly the way I dreamt it, you know, within a day or a week. But I remember through these journeys I took, I went to see a lot of different mediums, and some of them were just unbelievable. And I remember one in particular, and I was just listening to it actually a couple weeks ago, and she was an astrologer from New York, and I remember thinking I loved her voice, but absolutely everything she said was wrong, right? That's what I remember. But I was writing some notes down, and I was trying, you know, I'm trying to write another book, and, you know, and it's really about these journeys into the paranormal, I guess. And I listened to her recording, and the way she spoke about past lives, and then what she told me that was going to happen in 2020 was so spot on. And I hadn't, you know, I remember sort of brushing her off as, oh, she was super nice, I loved her voice, but she was completely useless and wrong. She was right about everything. About my daughter's pregnancies, about my, you know, some of my relationships that are happening. I mean, it was crazy. So, I mean, I think that, you know, go and get a reading with somebody good and tuck it away for a couple of years, and then, you know, open it up and wow, that's like real magic. It was just unbelievable.
Do you believe that your family were visited by the ghosts of the life that they had to leave and the loved ones that they lost and left behind?
I do think we are. Many people have visits. I know that my father, who died about a year ago, before he died, he had very clear visits from some of his aunts and his mother. So yeah, I do believe that. I don't know that. I think people often have them and maybe they don't share them, or they don't think, they just thought maybe it was a dream. I think a lot of people have visitations in their dreams. I certainly have. And I think a lot of people write that off as, oh, maybe I was just thinking about that person. And maybe that's true. But often they're pretty clear visits. So yeah, I absolutely believe we all get visits. And, you know, some of us are going to say, yeah, that was a visit. And some of us are going to say, no, that was just a dream.
I know this was important to you, but what are the significance of the pictures in the book?
So there are pictures at the end of the book of the actual people in my family. And again, the significance is really to give another layer, I guess, because hopefully, you know, from reading my words, you get a sense, you know, of what the people look like and the setting. And I think it's cool to add that other layer so you can sort of see, oh, well, that's what it really looked like. I mean, for me, I love reading a story and then having pictures to go along with it. It just gives depth, I think.
I agree. Where can people find Where Madness Lies? I mean, I know we have a link to Amazon. Is there other options and versions of it as well?
Well, it's you can go to my website, sylviatrue.com. You can go to the publishing company, which is wonderful, John Hunt. But yeah, almost all the bookstores like Barnes & Noble, it's easy. If you Google Where Madness Lies, a bunch of links will probably pop up.
Fantastic. Sylvia, thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your family stories, yours and the twists with the paranormal. I know our listeners appreciate it. We have a link up today in the program guide information on where people can find you and the book Where Madness Lies. I hope that 2021 is as stress-free and anxiety-free for you as possible.
Right. Oh, thank you. It was wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We will be back tomorrow, folks. We've moved Supernatural News Parashare till tomorrow, since we are observing Holocaust Awareness Day today, January 27th. So we have released the show. We'll be back tomorrow with normal Supernatural News and Parashare. I hope you'll check that out and spend some time with us. Then, of course, Friday, we've got a brand new episode of Holzer's Ghosts. That's right. So make sure you tune in this Thursday night. Go to our YouTube page, Darkness Radio YouTube page, or follow me on my social media pages, and you can watch along. I'll be talking about the newest, as we revisit season one of the Holzer Files. We'll be going back and re-examining each one of those episodes and talking to special guests. I hope that you'll check that out, and you can hear the audio version on that every Friday. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to Darkness Radio.